Hi, this is Tony from the Everton Fans Forum bringing you the latest episode of our monthly podcast. We are taking a slight change in the approach this month. As regular listeners will know, our podcasts normally bring together a few members of the Fans Forum where we discuss and share the outputs and the topics that we discussed with officials at Everton Football Club. But given that our last meeting in January was a little bit shorter than usual, given that it came pretty swiftly after the Christmas and New Year holidays, we've decided not to do that this month. If, however, you are interested in learning more about what we did discuss with the club at the end of last month, then you can visit and access the minutes of that meeting at the Fans Forum section of the main Everton Football Club website, as you can with all our previous meetings, if you're interested. And if there's anything in there that you see that you're interested in or you want to give us feedback on, then as ever, please don't hesitate to get in touch with us. So instead of that usual format, this month we're bringing you an interview that we recorded last year, actually, with an Everton fan who will be known to many of you that are listening to the podcast today. That's Dr. David France. We spoke to David back in October about his journey as an Evertonian, about his many books that he's written about Everton and the legends that are connected with the club, his tireless work to preserve Everton's history and what Everton means to him. Since we spoke, he's completed work actually on his latest book called Toffee Soccer, which charts the historical links between Everton and North America, whether that be through players, coaches, or the many tours that the club has done. That's going to be published in May, and I'm sure that we'll be hearing more about that in the coming months and what promises to be a fascinating read for all Blues everywhere across the world. But in the meantime, we hope you enjoy our discussion with Dr. Everton. Welcome, everybody, to the latest edition of the Everton Football Club Fans Forum podcast. We're taking a little bit of a departure from our routine format this time. Normally, we'll provide you an update of the discussions and the meetings that we're having with the club on issues relating to things that you've told us matter to you most. But this time, we're going to have a conversation with somebody who's actually been described as probably one of the greatest ever Evertonians. He's a lifelong Evertonian who's travelled over 2 million miles to watch his beloved team and whose commitment to preserving Everton's history is second to none. He's published 18 books about Everton, soon to be 19, which we'll hear a little bit more about later on in the discussion. He established the Gladys Street Hall of Fame to preserve the greatest Evertonians in our history. He's established the Everton Former Players Foundation, set up to help former Everton players suffering from medical or other hardships, a model that's now been replicated by some of the greatest football clubs across the world. And he's probably most famous for the role that he played in establishing the Everton collection. Over 18,000 items dating back to 1886, preserving the very history of our great football club. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined this evening by Dr. David France. David, very warm welcome to you. How are you?
Good afternoon, Tony. It's going to be a hard act to follow that wonderful, eloquent introduction.
It was all the elocution lessons that my mum and dad made me have when I was a kid, when I was in Garston.
Well, they've paid off, young man. You've done very well.
That's another reason why it's great to speak to you, because every time I do speak to you, David, you always call me young man. So I'm very appreciative of that.
But well, at my age now, everyone is young.
So listen, David, there's obviously lots to talk about, and some of the things that I include in that introduction will be part of the next hour or so. Before we start at the beginning, how have things been for you? You're now in Arizona, in sunny climates in the US, but how's it been for you over these last few months in this sort of strange year?
Well, it is a strange year, and we live in Sedona, Arizona, which is in the high desert, which we're a mile high, and it's the area of the country where we have those fantastic red rock formations. Obviously, we attract a lot of tourists, and we've gone from lockdown early on during the pandemic to many of the businesses have opened, but there's a lot of small businesses that are still closed, and I seriously doubt whether they'll open again. So it's had a severe economic strain on the community. It's only a small community, but we're still getting visitors. Our bubble is being impacted by visitors coming over from California and Texas. So it's a strange time all around. We live in, as I said, in the desert, and it was only last night that I was woken by the sounds of coyotes. And really? My wife always refers to them as being copite coyotes because all they do is scream. And I guess they have some justification for their behaviour after the game at the weekend.
Absolutely. And it's still going on 24 hours after. So for everybody that's listening, we're actually recording this a day after the derby. So, yeah, a very apt description there, David. Fantastic. Well, listen, you're right. It's been really strange. And I know we've spoken a number of times over the course of the last few months, but I'm glad that you and Elizabeth are well. So listen, David, as I said, that there's so much to sort of get through, but what we've done in previous conversations with Evertonians on this podcast is to start at the very beginning and just sort of try and understand how people sort of became Evertonians in the first place and what their Everton story is. And one thing that I remember reading in one of your books, Everton Crazy, which is sort of partly your autobiography as well as a sort of deep dive into your love of Everton. But you don't describe it as a fandom; you describe following Everton as a condition.
Oh, it certainly is a condition. I think we're very lucky. I mean, which everyone should go and look in the mirror and look at themselves and see Everton on those faces, because we're very lucky. We follow a club that we should be proud of, with its history, with its community values, with its great bonds of camaraderie. I've often said that the Everton family makes biological families, it puts most biological families to shame. I think we share a special bond. And you know that if you bump into an Evertonian anywhere, besides in the United States, but if you bump into an Evertonian anywhere, after 5 minutes, it's if the long-lost brother. We have that kind of special relationship and something to be very proud of.
Very true. So how did it start for you then? How did you develop this condition then, David?
Oh, I was brainwashed as a kid. I mean, as simple as that. I come from, I'm a fifth generation Evertonians. The France family law says that we had an Uncle Billy who had share some of the original shares going back to 1892. And obviously, I don't know what happened to those shares, but the love of Everton was passed on from generation to generation. The oldest one I can remember is my grandfather, and he would indoctrinate me about Dixie Dean, who was his favourite. Of course, my father, he reinforced that love of Everton, and my father was no great fan of Dixie Dean. He'd seen him in his latter days when he wasn't as effective in the late 30s, and he was a big fan of Tommy Lawton. So we'd always had the family get-togethers, we'd always split up with this row about who was the better, Dixie Dean or Tommy Lawton. And I do remember my grandmother throwing a potato at them one time, which missed them and hit the budgerigar cage. They used to have a budgerigar, and they, like most people, back then in the cage, and it rattled the cage, and I don't think the budgerigar was that pleased because it cleared off about 2 weeks later.
I was going to say, did it survive? You lost it then?
Oh, it was first time it saw an open window, and it thought it'd go to find some peace and quiet somewhere else.
There you go. Once Everton's touched you.
Yeah. Okay. But it's always been the constant in my life, as a schoolboy. It always gave me that sense of belonging, the one thing that was always there, as I said before, something to be proud of.
Oh, no, completely. I think we can all relate to that sense of belonging. So what are you, and I'm sure that many people listening to this, David, have read Everton Crazy, which sort of plots your journey, but what are your earliest memories as a young, you know, as you said, you were brainwashed by the family, but of going to the game and getting to Goodison.
Well, I was a sick kid. I always say we lived in poverty, and I know it wasn't third world poverty, but it was a terrible state of affairs, following the Second World War. We lived in poverty where we only had the one electric light and the one cold tap. We didn't have bathroom, didn't have a toilet, etc. So we were, we didn't have much going for us, but my parents were Methodists, and they were very strict, but they had this great belief that life is an adventure. And I always say that they believed that living was more than just breathing, that you should go out and experience life. So when I was about 6 or 7, I said I was a sickly kid. I'd had scarlet fever, I'd been in isolation hospital, all those types of things. They bought me a season ticket to go and watch Widnes play rugby league. We lived in Widnes. Well, that is just, nowadays they would be reported to the authorities for child abuse. And so I would make my own way there. It was the only grass that was in Widnes at the time. And it was only about a quarter of a mile away. We lived in the centre of the town. So I'd wander there, wander back. And when I came back, I had to, we had the Rediffusion radio. That was like wireless, that was pumped into the house, and I had to get back in time to put down the football results I think it was called Sports Report, something like that, on the Radio 2, what would have been the light, I'm not sure what the name of the channel was then, and or the station was. So I had to write those down for my dad, because my dad work shifts, like most people in Widnes, he worked in the chemical works, and he worked shifts. So I'd do that and hopefully get them all correct for him. And then he'd talk to me about, the different teams. They all sounded, the teams back then, the guy used to read out the results. He could make the Scottish second division sound like some romantic place, Cowden, Beath, and Stenhouse Moor and the likes. I'd always pestered my dad about going to the match, and he wanted me to go, but my mum said I was too weak and tiny and whatever, wasn't, big enough. So I had to endure two years of rugby league before I could go. And I went for my first game in September 1957. It was against Manchester United, the famous Busby Babes. Oh. It was, there was 73,000. In those days, Goodison used to get a really good crowd. There were 73,000 at Goodison, and we stood in the paddock. I stood on a metal crate. My dad had brought a milk crate, one of those metal milk crates. He was a big, he was a big muscular guy, and he'd carried this along for me to stand on. And I don't remember that much of the game, except it was a 3-3. I didn't see much of the game, but I obviously, the noise from the crowd and the smell of the crowd, and it was just something. It's everything that I'd hoped it would be. It was an incredible experience. And as I said, we drew 3-3. Unfortunately, 6 months later, the Manchester United side perished in Munich in the air disaster. So the 3-3 result, they were the league champions at the time, by far the best team. And ours were just, we used to always say they were like 8 Scousers and 3 Paddies. That's what we were. We were all homegrown with a sprinkling of Shamrocks in the side, and that's no offence to anyone. And then by the time I got to, I went with my dad a few times. By the time I got to 11, he let me go on my own. And so at 11, that was going to the home games on my own. By the time I got to 12, he'd let me go to, my mum, really. My dad had encouraged me to go, but my mum, she was really strict about, she was mindful of me. Let me go to the away games, the local away games, the Boltons, the Blackburns, okay. You know, the Stokes, those kind of Sheffield. And then at 14, I decided to pursue a life of hitchhiking.
Really? At 14?
Yeah, I went with kids who were older than me. And it was dead easy because there was a lot of traffic coming in out of Widnes, you know, with the, this was before the motorways, with the chemical trucks going everywhere. So we would go to a cafe, a motorway, not a motorway cafe, but a local cafe where the trucks stopped. And we'd go and ask if anybody was going to wherever we were going. And not in those days, you know, they would normally give you a lift. You know, it's a lot easier to pick the person that you get a ride with than actually stand on the road with your thumb out. So we did that. And it was a great way of maturing. It's a great way of finding your independence and excuse me.
And just back to your mum and dad as well. So did your dad? Did your dad stop going, or did he?
He went irregularly because he worked shifts. So whenever he was available, he would take me, and he'd take my mum as well. And we graduated from. I would go into Gladys Street, and then I had a period where I would go into the ground, the Goodison Road side terraces, because you could walk round. There was a barrier between Gladys Street and Goodison Road. Near the churches, yeah. And you couldn't go from Goodison Road into Gladys Street, but you could walk all the way around to what we now call the Park End. And that's what football fans did. They always went and stood behind the goal that their team was playing in. So when you were away from home, for example, you'd change ends at half time. You know, you'd go, you'd all start out somewhere, and then you'd go at half time, you spend your time getting behind the other goal. No, my dad, he would take my mum. And it was like a family. It was a night out for us. It was a bonding session, I think, for the family.
Oh, that's really important. Again, sort of helps cement that feeling of belonging to something. And I hope you don't mind me saying this, but you I think you described again. I think it was in Everton Crazy. You described your mum Una as the Lee Carsley of mothers. I just wondered if you could add a little bit of colour to that.
She was a special lady. She was a Geordie. And she came from a dysfunctional family, and she joined the RAF when she was 17. And she used to count the planes coming back in,
right.
And that was her job. And therefore, she was the one who had to tell them that, you know, some of them are missing. Sweet. And so she had. She was very mature, very bright. Extremely bright, but she worked in a laundry washing other people's clothes because, you know, there was no avenues for women then, no matter, you know, she hadn't got the schooling that you required. But as I went about my education, she was very supportive, very encouraging. She'd had, you know, she didn't suffer fools, that was for sure.
Yeah.
And but she was hard working. You know, without any, the comparison I make with Lee Carsley is the fact that we didn't fully appreciate Mother until she was gone.
Wow.
And then we realized that all the things that she used to do for us, that mothers do for the children and the families. And I always thought to say, I told Lee Carsley that. And he was quite pleased by the comparison. Nice. Maybe it was because I had tears in my eyes when I was explaining it to him. But
yeah, that's lovely. That's really good. That's really good. And you, David, the other thing I wanted to just touch on as well is because we're going to talk about some of the writing that you've done, but you said as well that, you know, you were a sickly kid and what have you. And again, in your book, you know, you talk about sort of some of the struggles you had early on with literacy. But actually, football got you sort of on the path to sort of reading and writing, didn't it? And when you were a young kid, when you started reading, was it Billy Bingham's books about soccer?
Yeah, it was. I couldn't read till I was 14. I missed a lot of school, and I was bright, but I couldn't read. I couldn't figure it out at all. And 14 is late to be learning how to read. Therefore, I mean, I went to a secondary modern school, which was great. When you can't read, you sort of guess at reading. I mean, you know, it's even more embarrassing when you're hitchhiking. You can't read. Who knows where you're going to finish up? But I couldn't read. I was embarrassed about reading. I didn't want to read. You know, I couldn't, you know, follow the basic instructions. And then on my own, I thought that maybe at some point I'm going to have to learn to read to be a part of the real world. And my uncle, I think, I don't know whether it was out of, he was demonstrating some kind of wisdom or spite. For Christmas, he bought me a copy of Billy Bingham's Soccer with the Stars. It was his biography. And I thought, well, I'm going to read this, which I did. It took me a week or so to read it. And then by that time, I went down to the Widnes Library and started taking out books. So many years later, I got myself a decent education.
Fantastic. Amazing. We're going to talk about your journey from sort of the early days in Widnes that you just touched on to how you ended up in Arizona at the moment. But I wanted to just... wants to pick your brains on one particular journey that you made, I think, to go and see or go and try and meet the famous Dixie Dean once. That again, that's in your book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when we, I said my dad was no great fan of Dixies. I think he was a bit overweight and he didn't perform maybe as, you know, my dad had been led to believe. And I have to say my grandfather had seen Dixie score his 60th goal. He'd been to Wembley in 33, etc. So, you know, my dad, maybe it was, you know, a bit of a problem with his own father, but he was not, he wasn't Dixie's biggest fan. So when our big day out from Widnes was going to Chester to go shopping, not that we bought anything, but we went there to go shopping and look around the rows and look through the shops. And while my sister and my mother went, you know, doing the things that they did, my dad would take me around the Roman walls. And one place we'd come down at was near the Dublin Packet, which was the pub that Dixie had at that time, or the Dean family had at that time. And I mean, you know, my dad didn't drink. I come from a family of non-drinkers. And I couldn't convince him to take me inside to see Dixie, who worked behind the bar, and he had all his medals and international caps behind the bar and plaques, etc. So my dad wouldn't. He refused to go into the pub. So we must have done this about three or four times, and it became quite something that my dad wouldn't do this. So a friend of mine and I decided we'd go on our own. In those days, to get across the Mersey in Widnes, you had the transporter bridge, which was this cradle that dangled from this metal structure, or you could go on the railway bridge, which still exists, and there was a footpath. A very narrow footpath on the side of it, where there was a toll, I think it was a penny to go on this. And we walked along there, and the trains would come past. The trains would be like about a foot away from you, you know, the Liverpool to London to Liverpool train would come blasting past you, you know. So it was an adventure in itself. And then we'd get the bus to Chester. And once we got to Chester, we found the pub easy because it's right next door to the town hall in Chester. And we climbed up. Remember, we were little scallywags, you know, so we climbed up the back of the yard. At the back of the pub, there was a yard where they kept the bottles and the old crates and you know, whatever. And we climbed there waiting for Dixie to come out. And he did. And he looked nothing like the photographs that we'd saw of him. We'd seen this really athletic guy with a centre parting and, you know, a handsome guy, you know. And it wasn't. This guy came out swearing at us. And I always remember he wore a belt and braces. I always thought that, you know, he wore them both. He had this collarless shirt on and his sleeves rolled up. He was carrying empty bottles or something like that and putting up and shouted, told us to clear off or whatever. And when I told my dad afterwards what we'd done, he said, well, you got nearer to him than many centre halves ever did. So,
very good. Okay, well, I'll tell you what. There's not many that can say that they met Dixie, and it was a special story. Also, the fact that you and your companion sort of did what you did to get there shows the sort of adventurous spirit, I think, that you know that you've got. So, David, I just want to move on now to sort of the legacy, basically that you've you know begun to put in place and create on a number of different fronts, really, which is just truly impressive. And the more I hear and read and listen to you talking about is just staggering. But we'll get onto some of the specifics in a minute, but you started to collect sort of things about Everton as well on your travels and as your career progressed. So tell us, how did you start collecting?
Well, we all collect, don't we? As school kids, we collect. I had to, my mother used to let me go to Everton or go to away games in particular, but to prove that I'd done so, I had to bring back a copy of the programme, you know, that there wasn't misbehaving somewhere else. So, you know, by the time, like we all do, I think by the time you're a teenager, you have your own little stash of memorabilia. And mine was kept in a Batter shoebox. Remember the shoe company Batter in a shoebox? And when we'd moved to Houston in the early 80s, my mother contacted me and said that she was cleaning out and she'd come across these souvenirs and she needed to know what to do with them. Should she throw them away or what? I said, oh God, no, you know, send them over. Let me, you know, let me live my childhood again. And that's what she did. This shoebox came over by Royal Mail and you only have to look at it and all the memories come back to you. You know, you can remember not necessarily who scored in the games, just looking at the programs or the tickets or whatever, but or the fixture lists, but you remember going to the game or going something happening at the game or something happening before the game or after the game or the weather or something about it. You know, it all the memories come back, which was wonderful. And I decided I'd offer these to Everton, and wrote to Everton, and didn't get a very good reply. I asked if they wanted them to include in their archives, and I'm sure that other people have done the same, but the club said they didn't have any archives and they weren't interested. So I decided that maybe I should do something about it and build some archives. You know, because one of the things we have going for us is the fact that we're currently in our 118th season in the top flight, which is like 30 seasons more than Manchester United and 35 more than Chelsea and Tottenham and whatever. I mean, we really have a pedigree to be proud of, and we need to have the evidence to support that pedigree. And to do that was collecting memorabilia, which wasn't fashionable at the time. It wasn't something that people did. But I went about it in a scholarly way, let's say, as if it was an industrial project. I made a list of all the things that I wanted and I provided that list to it. Then there were some companies that were dealers in memorabilia, and I gave them the list of what. And it all came in. It was quite incredible. I've said this before, but I didn't get other people's programs. I got the lives, the life stories. I got the boxes of, you know, memorabilia where they would look at, you know, their own experiences. And when it all came in, it was just the mountain of it. And so I concentrated on knowledge. I was interested in knowledge, written paper in good condition. And wanted quality items. And I soon picked up all the post-war programs home and away and overseas. So then I focused on pre-war, pre-Second World War, and then I focused on the 19th century. And of course, by then, I was spending big money, which my wife didn't object to, well, to my face anyway.
Exactly, she didn't know what was that, how much you were spending.
She didn't know. No, she sometimes accompanied to Christie's. By now, of course, places like Christie's and Sotheby's have got into this, and they were selling medals and you know, and some very expensive items, and I wasn't so keen on buying medals until I realised that Everton weren't buying them, so I needed to buy them, and you know, to secure them, you know, because like these were. Normally, where footballers have passed away in the family have, you know, they've been left the medals, and there's not enough medals to go around, so they decide to sell them and split the money rather than, you know, start family arguments over who gets what. So it's just the way of the world. So I wanted to secure them for Everton. So I'd go to, the sales were up in Glasgow, so I'd, in the summer my wife would come over to see her parents, you know, in the summer, spend for, you know, a month or so with the parents, and that would coincide with the sales in Glasgow, and she'd go up with me, and we'd have a little conversation before about how much we were going to spend, because by now I thought I knew about memorabilia, you know, I thought I was an expert, you know, believe you me, that's not the case, and I would make an estimate of what I was going to spend, and she'd look at it and, you know, shake her head, but you know, didn't object. And of course, when you get into the heat of an auction, you sometimes you run away with yourselves, you know. I would always pay the one bid above what I said I would, then one for the pot.
Very good.
And I paid some significant prices, and on some occasions I got bargains. And then I decided to focus, rather than on the items at the auction, I'd focus on the families before they sent the items to auction, and so that I would, you know, I'd pick up everything. So I did. I mean, you know, one time I bought some guy's collection for 78,000, and I didn't tell my wife. And when we went, it was just before the when we played Ipswich in 1995. We'd played Ipswich at Ipswich, that's and right. We just stayed up. Joe Ryder right. Managed to keep us up.
Rideout, wasn't it? Yeah, I think. Yeah, I remember
yeah,
that.
He was on all it. Right, we... Yeah, and all the. Sorry, Norwich. Was it Norwich? I forget now. Whichever one it was.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and they everyone in the ground applauded Everton as they came off, which I thought was really sporting. My wife went to the game with me, and then. We went to pick up the items, a swag, as she would call it, from a fellow collector out that way. And this was the 78,000. And she asked me, you know, I remember she pulled out Tommy Lawton's shirt that was in there. You know, sometimes when you buy stuff, you have to buy stuff that you don't want in order to make the deal. You know, you have to be very flexible, and I didn't want this Tommy Lawton shirt, but I bought it anyway. It was his kit, so there was his shirt, his shorts, and his socks. You know, only as I said to her, they've only been used once. You know, but apparently it was on it was his England kit. Wow. It was on a day when it rained because the shirt. The shorts had run into the shirt. The bottom of the white shirt was a very pale blue, and whatever. And she looked at this, and she just thought this was, you know, I'd lost my mind. You know, she just thought this was something for the charity shop. But I didn't tell her about that specific item. But she challenged me about how much have you spent, and I told her it was 78,000. Not, I mean, there were some real gems in there. Don't get me wrong. And she screamed, "Stop the car. Take it back." And I said, "No, I'm not." And she didn't speak to me. We drove to Wembley. You know, we were going to Wembley afterwards. And she drove to Wembley, didn't speak to me. It was quiet. It was the M1 was quiet that day, you could say.
That's a great story. That really is a great story. So there's now, I think, nearly 20,000 different items in the collection, which is... which I think is in the records office back in in Liverpool. And the other thing I like about this, David, as well, and we'll talk about this maybe in a short while, is how important sort of, you know, the pedigree and the history that you talked about is to us. And I think everybody's excited at the moment around, you know, the potential for us and, you know, what's going on the pitch, but also, you know, the expansion plans off it and all the rest of it. And obviously we've talked a lot about, you know, sort of the international growth plans for the club and how do you sort of get that combination between, you know, people that are new to Everton, but also sort of helping them understand that pedigree. But we'll talk about that in a minute. But what's your most treasured item? Is it possible to, do you know from sort of 20,000 items, what are the things that you think are most valuable, not in terms of monetary terms, but just for the future history of the club?
Well, I think it has to be the older items. Remember that this is a collection. It's not the magnificence of it is. It's a like the programs. It's a continual run from today until certainly 1904-05 when we shared the program with Liverpool. There's every program in there that Everton have ever played, home and away. I mean, it is that there may be one or two missing from the war periods. Where we don't know if the programs were printed, but it's a continuous run. It's this magnificent, you know, what any collector, and I don't think of myself as a collector. I just thought to myself, well, this was a project that needed to be done. But it's a collector's dream that there's nothing missing, although it's completeness. So the collection itself is you know, as a source of information is quite significant. What I find to be the most valuable ones are going back to age, and we have when it comes to football programs, we have a complete set of the programs from Everton's last season as a non-league club, when they played against the Paddiums and the Northwich Victorias and the likes in 1887, which is just magnificent. The programmes, the collection is in extremely good condition because I would always buy items to replace the ones that weren't in as good condition. And also it tells the story, of course, as towards the end of that season, the Football League were organising themselves. Everton weren't amongst the candidates to be included in it. And they asked Everton, you know, if they... Of course, we had a great ground. Anfield was a superb ground and we got big crowds for the friendly games. And they asked Everton if they could play there. So we then started to play against the Aston Villas, the West Broms, the Boltons, the Prestons, the Stokes, Derby Counties, Notts County, you know, the teams that made up, that eventually made up the Football League. And I think we squeezed out one or two. It's often said that we squeezed out Bootle, but it's more likely that we squeezed out the Wednesday, Sheffield Wednesday and Nottingham right. Forest to be considered in those 12. And of course, we also have the full volume of programmes from the first season of the Football League, including our first game. But also like 40 friendlies that we played that season. And they include games against Rangers and Celtic, which was Celtic's first season. So we have the history of other clubs as well. One, I think maybe the best example is against Newton Heath, which is Manchester United, and it's their oldest known piece of memorabilia. So it doesn't just tell the history of Everton Football Club or the social history of Merseyside. It tells the history of football in England and in Scotland, because a lot of the prominent teams at that time were Scottish. And then after that, we've got the full season of the season after. So we've got three volumes there that are treasures. I mean, they're irreplaceable treasures. They're not the oldest ones in the collection, but they're complete for their seasons. So there's that. And then, of course, I hunted down the minute books, you know, that the, like any good committee, what was the board of directors or the management committee of the club would detail everything that they ever did. They would meet twice a week and then sometimes they would have an emergency meeting. So they date back to, I think it's, I may have my dates wrong, but it's like 1890. It's before we left Anfield, and it's got all the decisions that we made from, you know, the fact we're going to leave Anfield to, and these are sort of, every page is signed off by John Holding, etc. And to, you know, we need to hire a horse and roller to come and roll the pitch, or we need to do something, and you know, at the ground, we need to put new wash basins in the ground or something. Every decision that they made, oh, we're going up to Scotland, and we're going to, you know, we're going to recruit players, and then it would report that they've done the scouting and they've added someone to the team. That carries on up to the mid 60s. So we've got like 80 years of Everton's history, which really is the social history of Liverpool. But in, I'm saying that, but then you couldn't. We've also got the quotation from the builders for the building of Anfield. I mean, it's quite remarkable. But my favourites are the small ones, which are the season tickets. We have season tickets from when we played at. At every ground that we played at, from Stanley Park to Anfield to Goodison, etc. We've got complete season tickets with that, which I think are just, these are the items that people would normally throw away, but for some reason, someone in the past, and thank goodness that they did, they saved them. And that's when I realized they need to be put in this. That's what makes us special. Nobody has anything like this. It makes us, you know, when you ask me about Everton, I just think of it as being special. Yeah. And whatever we do in the future, we should always think of it that way. How can we make ourselves special? And our history is one, is just one part of that.
Well, it's, I mean, what you've done there to assemble that, and as you say, the history that you just described and those few examples that you've provided is, you know, is really, really powerful. What you know, obviously we're about to, you know, we're on the verge of moving to a new stadium, and there's sort of the next sort of phase of Everton's evolution as a club. Where does the Everton collection fit within that, David? I mean, sort of physically, but also as part of this next phase, because I think this is critical to... to as I say, to the next phase of Everton's growth. You know, was it going to be part of the stadium plans, or what? You know, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm not in. I mean, I transferred the collection to the Collection Charitable Trust in 2007. It took 3 years to transfer it, to raise the funds to do it. Of course, the club at that time wasn't well off. It didn't have the money to pay for it. And I have to say, we sold it at about half its value. You know, we sold a significant discount, because whilst we had, and you'll like this, we had a house in Chester at the time. We bought a house in Chester so my wife could look after her parents, you know, who lived in Bolton. And when I decided, through my own ill health, we would sell these. I said to sell them. I wanted to transfer them to Everton. But obviously I'd spent a few bob on this, and I expected to get at least back what I'd paid, and which was quite significant. And so we had open houses where we invited different people to come and inspect the collection. And we had three parties associated with Liverpool would come, because what I've just spoken to you about is Liverpool's you know, you could say, is part of Liverpool's history as well, Liverpool Football Club's history. So we had the whoever was the CEO or whatever at the time of Liverpool, he came. And in every room of the house, we had something. I mean, this is a lot of stuff to have. You know, we normally kept it in the vault in the bank. It was that precious, but this time they had to leave all. They might as well have done it in the nude, you know, because they had to leave everything behind, so we didn't. So none of them would take. Not that anyone from Liverpool would ever do anything illegal, of course, but Liverpool Football Club would ever do anything illegal. But they. So they could go and rummage around and look through and etc. And of course they were really impressed. And then they had people representing Liverpool Football Club from the Far East and from the Middle East, and they sent attorneys to do that. And they were the first ones to come with a bid, and they bid was like £1.4 million, something like that. And we declined. Both of them came with about the same range. And Liverpool themselves didn't make a bid, but they would have. But right. These parties did. And then we had people who just wanted to bid on certain items. And then we took us 3 years to negotiate with Everton to pay £800,000 is what we took, but of course that's where I wanted it to go. I mean, I never was it going to go to Liverpool. It may have gone to the City, but I always wanted it to go to Everton. But it took them a little bit of while to raise the funds, and in the end, Lord Grantchester, who was he should take a tremendous amount of credit for, for steering this project. He's the grandson of John Moore, Sir John Moores. He made a big contribution, as did Everton, financial contribution, and then they got lottery funding, which allowed them to buy the collection, also get it organised and audited, etc., in the record office.
Well, listen. I hope there are people listening at the club as well about what we can do to build on this. Obviously, with the group that's taken on board and Lord Grantchester, because I think it's absolutely critical. Let's fast forward to today, though, David, because talking about getting things done, you've got another project. I said that you'd written 18 books. I think you're still working or close to finalising your 19th. I think is right. And obviously. Actually, this is a topic that's sort of close to my heart as well, because we got to know each other this year when I got interested in the fans forum and sort of have been trying to give our international fan base, and particularly the US fan base, a bit of a voice. And that's how you and I have got to know each other. But your latest project is specifically, again, it's about history and the connections between Everton and the past and the future. But it's specifically about the connection between Everton and North America.
Yes, it is. And let me, before I start my ramblings again, let me just say that I do appreciate, and I think everyone I've spoken to appreciates, the initiative that you've taken, Tony, and I congratulate you on the work you've done so far. There's a lot of work to be done to develop our international image and our international presence profile of what it is. There's a lot of work to be done to educate, be it North Americans, South Americans, just how special we are. And I'm really thrilled that you and the club have embraced this. What this is a book. We're writing a book. It's now 550 pages. It's a short one, and it involves some smashing people. I've recruited Darren Griffiths. Who's the voice of Everton, he's the publication manager of the editor. Diehard. Blue to the core Evertonian, great guy to work with, fantastic contacts, really enthusiastic. And also our other joint author is Rob Sawyer, whose great grandfather was once the secretary of Everton Football Club. And Rob I'd worked with on a Roy Vernon book, and I've known for many years. He's part of the Heritage Society that I set up, and he writes articles on. He has a wonderful way on the telephone with people. I think he lures them into revealing the secrets about their lives when he interviews old players. So he does some top-class research. Which I think should be appreciated by more people. Anyway, I was having lived in the States for a long time, I decided that there was something special between Everton and North America, and that's what I wanted to research and investigate. I'd started this back in, must have been about 20 years ago, when for some reason I bought this scrapbook, which I wouldn't normally buy anything like that. It was something the guy said to do the deal on something else. He said, oh, let me throw in this scrapbook and whatever. And it was a scrapbook of just newspaper cuttings, but there were newspaper cuttings from local American and Canadian titles, newspapers, about our tour, our first tour to the United States, which was in 1956. And somebody had meticulously preserved these. And it reads a great story. And what I went about doing was interviewing some of the people who'd been on that tour. This was 20 years ago when a lot of them were still alive, who'd been on that tour and who, you know, I had met through the former Players Foundations or something else and become good friends with. And they told me some great stories. You know, it's... soccer in in the United States was pretty primitive at that time. They, you know, besides beating England in the World Cup, which you know they did in Brazil, it was a nothing of a game. It was played by immigrants. It was played. There was no national league or anything. So for Everton, when they toured in 1956 in North America, the USA, they only got crowds of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. Okay. Even in the hotbeds, even in New York, etc., they got more when they went to Canada. Anyway, I gathered all these stories up, and then we went back in 1961, and that's the tour when we played in the International Soccer League competition. And we won our section of it. We got to the final and we got trounced by Dukla Prague 7-2. And being a good friend of Brian LeBone and Alex Young, etc., they told me stories of what that was like. That what I remember, one of them was on the flight home, they flew into Burton Wood, the aerodrome, and which you shake your head thinking about. They flew into there, and the all on the flight home, John Moores, who was the chairman, he wouldn't speak to anyone because he was so disappointed in them, because he was under the belief that English soccer, British soccer, was the best in the world.
Highest levels.
And you know, and he wasn't in touch with the reality that, you know, other people played it, and some of them played it better than us. And I'd looked at that and I thought, well, sometime I need to put the book together on this. Well, fast forward another, you know, 20 years. And I got Darren and Rob involved. And, you know, we have a special relationship with North America. We've played 35 games in North America. We've been on 10 tours to North America. That's more than any other English club. We've had our players, former players, have played for 155 North American clubs in the different leagues that we've had over here, and you get the gist of this. That's more than any other English club. These players have they represent 10 members of the different US Canadian Soccer Halls of Fame. That's again more than anybody else. And of course, we've recruited perhaps the best American players and Canadian players that there ever were, and you know, which is Landon and Tim, Tim Howard. So we pulled all this stuff together. We profiled everyone. The book profiles everyone. Then we decided to go about talking to them. So we've interviewed about 70 of them that are still around. And 70 of them from Tim Howard and Tim Cahill, Wayne Rooney. I'd already talked to Alan Ball many years ago about it. And we've got all their inputs, but we've also got, you know, the guys who go over and, you know, they play for some American team and they decide to stay and they coach. you know, the coach at university and the coach at to you know, high schools or whatever. But they're laying down the roots. They're spreading the Everton name. And there's dozens of those guys who, you know, I think everywhere, if I guess you could plot a map, it'd be interesting to see where they all are, because they're scattered all throughout the USA. I mean, down the road from me in Phoenix, we've got Paul Ryder. And down in Houston, we've got Earl Barrett. And I mean, they're everywhere. And
yeah. Brian McBride is quite local to us here in Chicago. He unlike it, you know, I think he only played 8 times for us, Brian McBride, but he helped us out with a fundraiser for the Chicago Evertonians last November, and was very supportive, happy to meet. And you know, just even with his brief sort of history with us, spoke so fondly as well about, you know, connection and some of the people he's still involved with. And I think what struck me about what you're working on, David, as well, is you know, I think we can all trot out, you know, the McBrides, the Howards, the Donovans and the Radzinskis and some of those players, the Max Moores and what have you. But what the book does actually, it goes back, and there's a surprisingly larger number of people that have connections
You go back to, you talk to Preki. One of our guys talked to Preki. He didn't get a word in. You know, the guy, Preki, spoke emotionally about Everton for an hour. You know, how important it was to his life. How much you think? Robert Wasika, Steve Sargent from, you know, he's still up in Detroit. There's Brian Quinn, who didn't make the first team at Everton, but fascinating story. Brian Quinn, the lad from Northern Ireland that we signed, he spent 2 years at Everton, didn't break into the first team, went over, played indoor soccer in California. And it was that good, you know, he created all sorts of records and everything. And they invited him to join the, you know, the USA national side. He never played outdoor soccer for like 8 years. And they asked him if he'd play. And of course, he said, I'm Irish. He said, oh, that's no problems. 2 weeks later, he was an American citizen. He had a green card and all the citizen, whichever it takes. And maybe it was citizenship. And he got 46 caps for the USA. A lovely guy. I mean, they're all lovely guys. You know, Adam Smith, who's up in Sacramento, you know, he was managing a team over in the States. Jimmy Gabriel, you know, of course, up in Seattle. We seem to have somebody everywhere, and which, of course, but no other club seems to have that. And our research has shown that. And the book it captures Everton's influence on North America. It captures our contribution to North America, and also the American contribution, or the North American contribution to Everton, be it through the names that you said. And it's quite a fascinating topic. Yeah. And that hopefully we use it. The intent is the club has embraced the project. Denise has written a very eloquent introduction to it, and hopefully we'll be able to use it in part of the engagement plans that I know that you're working on.
Good. Well, that's amazing. And look, I think what you said there about, you know, the depth of feeling that you know, that North Americans have for Everton, whether they played or they're following it, it's, I mean, I always knew that there was a really sort of strong connection between Everton and North America before I moved out here, but having spent time out here now, and you know, we've got a network of all the supporters, club leads, and I'll be honest with you, I underestimated the strength and depth of that feeling. So I think the book will have hopefully will play a huge part in, you know, the next phase, as we, you know, as we're, you know, the club talks about international expansion and you know, and growing that fan base and engaging it in a really good way. When can people get to read it then, David?
We had a little bit of a layout change this last weekend, so that's delayed things slightly. It's part of it's in the designers already, but you know, with the With the retail market at the moment, it's everything's up in the air. It was intended that the launch would be in the United States, and it would coincide with an event, let's say, associated with the club, which we were looking at sometime March, April. That, of course, is likely not to happen now with the health issues. So it may come out earlier than that, or it may come out still at that time. It's up the important thing for me is that, you know, we get this thing finished. And when we say it's an important part, I'd just correct you there and say it's just one part of a plan that we need to capture to wake the sleeping giant that is Everton in the United States. And there's some work to be done. We need to be having tours, and we need to be working hard at getting the name out there, establishing partnerships, having events, investing in the North American supporters clubs. I think that's the people who, you know, you've got to understand the market that you're looking at. That, you know, old timers like me, I live in the past. You know, my Everton's, you know, I look at the league table now, and that's how it was always was for me as a kid. You know, we were top of the league, you know, and, you know, we'd look how many points are we behind Liverpool. You know, are we ahead of Liverpool? Well, as everybody knows, we're now three ahead of them. I may repeat that, we're three ahead of them. But our younger fans, who American fans, who are from the Premier League and the MLS era, they see Everton slightly different than most. They chose Everton, and they chose Everton for certain reasons that we go into in the book. And we did a survey of the fans, and we need to we need to fertilize their interest with lots of activities to make them feel like they belong to something special.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think you're right in it. You know, it is one part of a broader plan, as you say. And the point you made around embracing the existing supporters clubs and getting them involved and helping them be part of that solution, that plan, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's absolutely critical. And I know as well from the conversations that I'm having, the willingness and the appetite and even the hunger is there. So, hopefully we can see that through. One final question, David. We've talked a lot about sort of your journey and the work that you've done. Do you want to talk about things on the pitch at the moment? You've seen many managers, different eras at the club, success, the tough times. But what's your sense about things at the moment with Carlo?
Oh, I go higher than Carlo. I think Carlo, his resume speaks for itself. He's top class. I congratulate Mr. Mashiri. Things had not gone quite the way that he'd planned, but he's stuck in there. He's been resolute in making his investments in the club, even when we appeared to waste a lot of money on people who weren't necessarily good enough. And I think now he's beginning to see the rewards of his ambition and his investment, his commitment. And I think we've got a fantastic owner. I don't expect to get a free season ticket for saying that. I just think that he's done a fantastic job, and I think that I think there's some cracking people work for Everton Football Club, and I think the way in which we've established our made ourselves special with having looked at community values, etc. I think we lead the way, and hopefully we lead the way with history. But that's something that we've got to transfer over to America. You know, we're not likely to conquer America. We just have to find our niche in America where we are seen as being something special. Going back to Carlo, I think I could talk for hours on this, but one thing that I think he's his own man. Everybody talks about what a tremendous manager he is. Makes everybody feel important. And that seems to have played out with the people that he's signed. I honestly can't understand some of the other people we've signed, some of the signings we've made in the past. It's like somebody who won the lottery and went out and bought Lamborghinis and God knows whatever else, and we just frittered away the money, which was shameful. But, I mean, as I said before, you know, that hasn't deterred Mr. Mashiri. He's still making this commitment, and it's beginning to show. I think we're maybe one or two players short of where we should be, but I think we're very competitive. You know, we're not doing this in isolation, but all we need is one of the so-called big six to slip, and we can get their place, and we can keep that place. That will be the challenge. I imagine we'll finish in the top six this year, and hopefully we'll win some trophy. Hopefully we'll win it at Anfield. That would be a tremendous year. But then it's building on that that's so important. And when it comes to, do you want to talk about the breakaway by Liverpool and Manchester United?
Well, let's leave that. Let's leave that maybe for another time. I think that's something that we can, you know, I'm sure we could probably have another hour's discussion about at another point. David, you know, I think first of all, thank you for making yourself available on a Sunday afternoon for you. It's been a fascinating conversation, as it always is with you. I've been fortunate enough to have many of these over the course of the last 12 months with you, and hear not just the stories and your journey, but, you know, to hear about what you've done to with others to, you know, protect, create, and then sort of promote, you know, the history of our great football club, I think is outstanding. And, you know, I think to your point, you know, there is a lot of things to look forward to with Everton at the moment, but, you know, what's going to be fundamental and has got to be critical to that has got to be to ensure that people understand the great history that we've got as a club. Because as you said, we've got to make sure that we can celebrate who we are, because in your own words, we're very special.
We're very special. As I mentioned to you before we came on, when you were talking about the Derby game, I reminded you of the fact that I wrote in one of my books that Everton and Liverpool is like art and pornography, and I still think that to be the case, particularly after the whinging at the weekend. But it's a pleasure to be on. I just wish all your listeners to keep safe, keep the faith, and take care of one another. Be kind to one another.
Thanks, David. Look after yourself.
Thank you.
As always, we're going to close today's podcast with a little musical ditty from our fan base. And this month it's brought to us all the way from Delaware in the USA by a couple of blues, Sean Rigby and her boyfriend Will Manville, who are going to give you a little bluegrass twist of a very familiar Everton song.
It's good news for the blues. There's no more time to lose, 'cause we're hot on the trail and there's no way we're gonna fail. Get your coat on and get moving. We don't know the meaning of losing. Come on, get down to goodness and pause.